Welcome to the basketball extravaganza that is Inside Ivy Hoops. I'm editor of Ivy Hoops Online, Mike Tony. Lot to go over. Oh my goodness, there's so much. We're at this point of the season where the games start flooding in. The back-to-backs are here, and joining me now, Rob Brown, staff writer extraordinaire at IHO. How are you, Rob?
I'm doing well, Michael. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm hanging in there. We got a lot of ground to cover here. We're going to see if we're up to it.
Okay.
But first of all, on the men's side, an awful lot this weekend. We got a lot of surprise about what went down and how it went down.
Yeah.
A big win for Princeton to complete the season sweep over Penn, 62-53 at the Palestra on a day of throwback to the 1979 Final Four team for Penn. It was really a throwback to all the season sweeps that Princeton has notched this decade.
Yes.
It was not the right throwback for Penn. And then, of course, Dartmouth followed that up with an 18-point explosion, just absolutely scorching hot shooting at Leed Arena to topple Harvard. That game could have went any way. I saw Kevin Whitaker of the erstwhile NYC Buckets say before the game that game, you know, anything could happen, and it did. It certainly did. Let's start with Penn and Princeton. You wrote a fantastic recap of the game for the site. What were your takeaways from how that went down? Princeton just stymieing Penn again.
Yeah, I guess the main thing I was surprised at Penn's effort. I really thought that with an extra week of rest, Michael Wong and Max Rothschild would have been a little bit farther along. Although, you know, with Max Rothschild, a back injury, you never know. I think I was a little worried when I saw that he wasn't in the starting lineup, and it just looked like they had the same energy. You know, Steve Donahue had done the whole back-to-back weekend thing when he coached Cornell and he went up against Yale, so I thought he would have a little bit more experience in this and get the guys ready for it. But I was really taken aback by the lack of urgency, given the fact that they had this three-game losing streak. They had already lost one to Princeton, didn't want to lose on their home court, and especially in front of the 79 team. That was my biggest takeaway. From the game itself, you know, it really, Richmond, Aririgusa, another fantastic game. Miles Stevens is absolutely back to the form he had when he was a sophomore. Devin Kennedy really rebounded well from that first game a week ago. A.J. Broder was pretty much the only guy at Penn who showed up. And again, they're relying a lot on him, and he's wearing down as the game goes on. Missed free throws, missed short jumpers. Nobody was there to bail him out. And you know, the poor guy can't do it alone.
Yeah, and to give Princeton credit, I think they forced a bit of that sluggishness in that this is a defense that is – very much not what it was last season, and that's a huge positive, at least in comparing last year's Ivy play to this year's Ivy play. And I noted to George Clark on the podcast last week that, you know, this defense is a lot more physical. It's a lot more tenacious, it seems. And they played it smart, too. Penn is not a team that is designed to just beat you in isolation off the dribble. You know, you do see Broder get a lot of ISO inside, but this is more of a ball movement oriented team. And the Tigers were, you know, they were very good at picking up their men and just getting in faces. And really, they seem to impose their will and set the tone. And something that is very uncharacteristic of Princeton historically and statistically is their offensive rebounding. And they had 16 offensive rebounds at the Palestra last Saturday. Ruro Guzzo had 4. It was just, they outscored in a game where there were a lot of rebounds to be had because there was a lot of ice cold shooting to go around. Princeton had 21 more rebounds than Penn. 55-34 was the discrepancy. And, you're not going to, it helps you wear down that much more when you're on your heels and you can't end possessions and you can't be the aggressor going to the other end of the floor. And I feel like even when Princeton didn't convert off of those offensive boards, it kind of bore into any momentum that Penn did have from it being, well, it's the 79 teams here, and there was a 2010 lead early on. Eerily similar in that Penn built an early lead and then kind of just cooled off from that point basically on. I thought it was a slightly less sloppier game than the first go round of Jadwin, but still it raises questions about where Penn is at this point in the season. But for Princeton, I mean, as you said, everybody's on right now, except for maybe Jalen Llewellyn, but it's good to not be overly reliant on a rookie, however promising he might be. It was a really inspired performance by Princeton. It's not often that you miss 17 of your first 19 shots from the floor and have 7 turnovers just past the midway point of the first half and you win. But when you're able to win games ugly, that's a sign of a good team, particularly on the road against your arch rival.
For me, I was really impressed. I think Richmond had picked up his 4th foul with about 9 minutes to go, and then Max Rothschild actually made both free throws. So it was a 3-point game. And at that point, you kind of felt like here's Penn's chance to now with the big guy on the bench. And Miles Stevens just really stepped up. He hit the next 8 points for Princeton, and he almost got 2 more, except that dunk attempt he made from midway through the lane just missed. But he really single-handedly saved them at that point, and that was really a huge deal for Princeton. I think it's great for them going forward.
Oh, absolutely, and going forward, first for Penn. Penn has a back-to-back weekends of Big Five action. This coming Saturday, they're going to play at Temple in their final matchup against Fran Dunphy at the helm of the Owls. And, of course, it's hard to put into words what Fran Dunphy meant to Penn in the second most wins in Ivy League history. All-time winningest coach in Big Five history, and really just a special coach. In my limited interactions with him while at Penn, he was always very accommodating, very accessible. It wasn't often that an opposing coach would be accessible by phone to interview to preview a game, but he was always very. Always a very accessible and thoughtful guy during post-game pressers too, which I guess that's all just from a reporter standpoint, but from an Ivy onlooker standpoint in general, sorry to see him go. He's had a great run at Temple. The last couple of years, they've been sub-500 in conference play, but I don't know if you're you can't be too impatient as a fan, I don't think, as a follower of a program, realizing that college basketball is not all about wins and losses. I think, Temple fans should be happy with the Fran Dunphy era, I would say, and since this is an Ivy Hoops podcast, Penn fans are obviously, happy about, how the Dunphy era went down, all the Ivy League championships. You can't argue with that level of success. And all you have to see is what happened to the program after he left, how it collapsed. And, Fran Dunphy's don't grow on trees, I suppose. That's that matchup. And then St. Joseph's follows that. So it'll be interesting to see how, I mean, these games have always been pre-Ivy slate tune-ups in the past, and I think that's, even more so given the slide that Penn is on right now.
Yeah, for me, I would say, well, one, to echo your ideas of your thoughts of Fran Dunphy, I was still there during the Tom Schneider era, and I think he won one title. But by the end of that era, the program certainly never reached the depths it did during the Jerome and Glenn Miller time, but it was down, and Fran did a fantastic job, not just with wins and losses, but really creating a much more healthier and much more enjoyable culture for the team and for the university as a whole. And I see that same thing with Steve Donahue. So that's a great thing. And I think you're right. Not John Chaney's Temple team, but still something that his university should be really proud of. With these two games, I'm just hoping that Michael Wong and Max Rothschild just, if they have to sit out to get healthy for Cornell and Columbia in a couple weekends at the beginning of February, so be it. You probably lose the Big Five title, but that's worth it to make sure you get into the Ivy tournament, which the way the rest of the league is playing is not a certainty at this point.
No, not at all. Not at all. And just to go back to Dunphy real quick, it was announced today that Bill Bradshaw will be retiring from LaSalle, the AD there that while at Temple hired Fran Dunphy away from Penn back in 2006. So a bit of an irony there, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Happy trails sincerely to him in mm-hmm. retirement. So these tune-ups are going to be pretty critical. And then there's the anomaly that is Princeton's January schedule.
From one more year, I guess.
I think one, maybe two. I'm not certain. No, I've not gotten a clear answer as to when the academic calendar changes for Princeton for its fall exams to be more reasonably in December rather than January as they are now. They have what is certainly not a Division I matchup with Wesley on the 27th. We're not going to be dwelling too much on Princeton, but it's always a challenge. Hopefully they don't get too cold before the what are going to be double road back to backs for both the P's. At the Empire State Swing, Columbia and Cornell, and then Yell and Brown. So that's another tough thing for Penn, is you're already 0-2. Now you've got four straight Ivy Road games to follow. They've dug a hole, and it's not an 0-6 sized hole, but but still, there's work to be done there.
It's interesting, right? If you look at, I guess we can compare it to Harvard on some level, is, you lose Ryan Bentley, and this team can still adapt to that, but you lose Wong and Rothschild, and they really aren't the same team. And then they come back, and they're both maybe not 100%. And that's obviously a big difference also. So they don't have a lot of room for error. It's not 0-6, but they need these guys, especially, like you said, Max Rothschild really, initiates that ball movement that's so necessary, and Michael Wong is one of the prime three threats for
these guys at their peak. Yeah, well, and speaking of teams held back by injury, Harvard did not have a good night at Leed Arena at all. It was really it was Dartmouth's first Ivy opening win in 12 seasons, I think.
Yeah.
if I have that stat correct. It was just a dynamic performance from Dartmouth. The thing about Dartmouth is, and not to get too Penn-centric, they remind me a little bit of Penn's makeup and approach in that, you know, they're very three-point oriented, and they've got their rim protector and Chris Knight. They can go inside, outside. The ball movement is there. They've got a high assist rate. You know, they take a fair number of three-pointers, but certainly their roster is that they convert them at a very high rate. You know, it's kind of the, and it's not just Donahue, it's really an Ivy League thing in general the last few seasons to take a very analytically driven approach. And Dartmouth seems to, by the way that Dave McLaughlin has led this team, has embraced that wholeheartedly. And, you know, we got to see it on full blast Saturday night. It's when you look at it too, you know, Harvard had a decent game offensively. They scored a point per possession. It's hard to say with Harvard because there was a lot of pregame. Well, Bryce Aiken looks dressed. Is he going to play? And Seth Towns has previously been reported to be closer than Aiken. So there's a lot of question marks there with what is going to be. You know, how much forward does the cupboard get for Harvard? But what were your takeaways from Dartmouth? How good can this Dartmouth team be?
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, you covered the 3-point shooting. It's phenomenal. And you know, there was one section in the first half. I think they were up by 1 point, 2019, 7 minutes to go, and then, you know, five different guys, I guess they had 5 3-pointers, 4 different people hit a 3-pointer. Knight ended up with a dunk. You know, next thing you know, 19-4 run. These guys can hit quickly, and they can do it from multiple players in multiple parts of the court. I was surprised by the 2-point production. I guess, you know, in the second half, Harvard was doing a lot more, you know, trying to keep them off the 3-point line, so it kind of gave them some easier backdoor cuts for good easy 2-pointers. But I guess it all predicated on the 3-pointer for me, and just how many people can score on that. You know, of course, Lewis was great. Of course, Towns was even better. But Juzang really made those guys run, and I thought he was the key to the co-championship. And I think he was a really big piece to Saturday night's puzzle as well. They had that. They were up by 4 about 10 minutes in. They were still close, and then he picked up a second foul. And at that point, that's when Dartmouth made its big run. And he almost single-handedly brought them back in the second half. So, you know, if Bryce Aiken can't come back, you know, that's horrible. But I think Harvard feels really comfortable having Juzang. It's Seth Towns is probably the bigger piece of that missing piece that's hard to replace.
Yeah, it is promising that Noah Kirkwood has been great. He had really strong games last month against GW and Mercer, and was you know, he had a decent game in less than 30 minutes of action at Dartmouth too. So he's somebody who's in that, you know, he's 6'7". He's shown that he can score inside and out. Maybe he is, you know, kind of fills that Towns role, to put it crudely. Yeah, I mean, you can't, every year there's a team, usually there's multiple teams in the Ivy that they lose players, whether it was Yale with Jordan Bruner and Mekhi Mason, or Penn with Bentley, or Princeton with Hans Brace. You just, you know, players get injured, and the makeup of the team changes, the dynamic changes, and you have to adapt. And Harvard has shown that it can be, you know, it can be dangerous even without those two. You know, the win at St. Mary's this earlier this season was really impressive. This Harvard team can it's still dangerous, but you know, it was just a very lopsided night, and it's going to be interesting to see. I do think that Chris Knight is somebody who should be getting and is commanding more attention as an anchor at both ends of the floor for the Big Green. And it's really not a surprise because he already showed us what he could do last year. But it's interesting because this team, it's kind of a veteran team in that the players that were hot Saturday night from deep, obviously Barry, and he's known as a three-point shooter. But then you've got Foy and Sister. You know, these guys are juniors that have been around a while, you know, were with the program coming in when McLaughlin did. And, yeah, I mean, they're just firing on all cylinders right now. And it's fun to watch.
It is. And I guess another big point I saw was the bench production, which I really wasn't expecting. They haven't had a lot of it. Emery was out for the game. I think he had a stomach problem, so they were already down one of their major reserves. And Slager, Rye, Samuels, I think they got 18 points between the three of them, hit some key three-pointers, gave them really good minutes, which I think, you know, was great for that night, but it's also going to help them when they have to go to the back-to-back weekends, which is a totally different beast.
Yeah, you always have to account for that. You need to have depth. If you're going to have some bench production, even only if it's one or two players, it's still got to be meaningful. I know Yale and James Jones, they've had some fairly short benches in the past, but you still need one or two players that can slot in, and they seem to have that capability for sure. Looking ahead, you've got Columbia, Cornell, Yale, and Brown this weekend. These are intriguing games. These are matchups that really could go, I think, either way. Yale and Brown, we were talking before we started recording here. That could be a high scoring game because you've got Brown has always typically been a pretty up-tempo, potent offense, but Yale is playing at a faster pace this year and is, you know, pretty explosive itself offensively. We've seen what they can do. They have scored at high rates against teams like, well, Miami, Iona, you know, certainly lesser teams, but well, Cal comes to mind, Memphis. I mean, their offense has shown up in a lot of big games this season, and the defense is pretty strong, particularly on the interior with them as usual. What intrigues you most about this Yale Brown matchup this weekend in Providence?
I'll channel a little bit of my inner Peter Andrews and just say that, you know, we're so Penn and Princeton centric, especially the last few weeks, that we've ignored, you know, a Yale team that's 10-3 in Penn Pom, and also, you know, a Brown team that's like 130. And it's great that these guys are going to get their time in the afternoon sun as it is. I think I'm really impressed with Yale is that, except for the rebounding, you know, their numbers are really reaching the 2016 championship level. Their top 50 in three-point shooting, their top 20 in two-point shooting. The assist rate, of course, is you know, top 15. These are guys that are really following James Jones's principle: share the ball, rebound, solid defense, really smart possessions, you know, high percentage shots. I also think that they're healthy, which is, you know, another thing that they haven't had in the last 2 to 3 years. And I also think that they have a bit of a chip on their shoulder. You know, they're really upset with how last year played out at the Palestra in the semifinal. And I think these guys are really ready to go. And now you got them taking on a Brown team, which is just playing great basketball. Like Yale, they're on a six-game winning streak. I think Brown is, what, 12-4, and it's the best non-conference record in the program history. The offense is maybe not as potent as it is was last year, but the defense is unbelievable. I don't know if I've ever seen such a turnaround. This was a team that was ranked in the 300s and upper 200s last year, and now they're top 50 to top 100 and even top 10 in certain metrics. It's incredible. I'm looking for I think you're right, a high scoring game. It'll be interesting I'm always curious with Brown, what's going to happen when they take that first hit and how are they going to respond? And, I think the good thing that they have the first game at home, but what'll happen, Yale's going to make you earn everything. What's going to happen when it comes crunch time? Last year, they had some problems in league play. And I want to see if this a little bit more experienced team that's playing so well right now, if they can recover better than they did last year.
Right. Yeah. Well, it was quite a matchup between the two last year in Providence. 1-point win for the Bears. That was not a game to forget. But looking at this squad, the biggest metric that stands out to your point is the defensive 3-point percentage. They're top 10 in that category, and I do think that is ripe for some regression, because they have played some teams that. It just went cold from deep. But I don't think that's obviously not a coincidence either. They've certainly tightened up, and defensive 3-point percentage is so huge in the Ivy League, as we've already touched on. Teams shoot a lot of threes in this conference. It's an analytically driven conference. All the metrics bear this out. Columbia, I think in Jim Engel's first season, was kind of the exception, but they've even come around to this 3-point shooting trend that's taken over all of basketball, really. You're going to see, I think it's going to be another exciting game between these two teams. It could go a long way towards seeding in the conference tournament. Who knows? To look probably too far ahead, but I think it was good to see Desmond Cambridge get some national attention with the Lou Henson Award announcements nominations last week. He's somebody that I guess is now on the national scene, in the national conversation. He's already got I think 6 KenPom game MVPs this year. That's good enough for an entire season, and we're not even in the conference play yet for them. So he's getting it done, and he seems to be getting it done more efficiently than last season too. Particularly at the end of last year, he kind of carried a bit too much of the offensive load, I think, at times. I don't think he's doing that this season. He's taking on just enough. And is becoming very Matt Morgan-like in his scoring efficiency. I heard you channel your inner Peter Andrews there, but it should be noted that he hates Yale too. So
duly noted.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm also curious with Brown is the interior play. Last night's game, they were the Brown broadcast was mentioning that Josh Howard was out. He had injured his ankle the game before. The people at Brown said that he's good to go for Saturday, but I don't know what that, they always say the player's ready, but how is he really 100%? And we certainly saw with Penn what it's like when you've got some front court guys that are not 100%. And now he and Tichel have to go up against a Yale front court that's Jordan Bruner, Blake Reynolds, Paul Atkinson. I mean, that's a lot even when you're healthy. If you're not 100%, that could be the make or break in such a close game.
Indeed, yeah, it's going to be a fascinating matchup to watch for all of those reasons. And so is Columbia at Cornell Saturday. It's not as sizzling of a matchup per se, because these two teams, Cornell and Columbia, I don't think at this point are anticipated to crash the tournament. Because they have some shortcomings. The Lions have lost Mike Smith. Cornell, there's not this roster for the Big Red is not doesn't seem to be right for a run. Or sort of the surrounding cast around Matt. What are your thoughts on where these two teams stand going into the pretty critical matchup to start the head-to-head for each here?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you on the one hand, as your point well taken, that these are teams that were picked in the preseason, you know, towards the bottom of the conference, but the last couple of years, it seems, since we've had the Ivy tournament. That last weekend, almost every 7 or all 8 teams seem to have a mathematical chance. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't discount anybody at this point. And now, yeah. You know, we just had a weekend where the number 8 team beat the number 1 team. So, you can't take anything for granted as you have Columbia and Cornell. And now you have to, like, realize that Dartmouth has a pretty solid upper division win in their resume. So these games are really critical. They're not necessarily make or break if you get swept, but it's pretty important with all the tiebreakers in place. Saturday's game, you know, I think it's going to be a 3-point, it's going to come down to the threes. Columbia's defense is not the strongest on the 3-point line, and that's been the last, something that's plagued them the last few years. Cornell's not the best team from three-pointers, but, you know, when you've got Matt Morgan, especially at home, anything can happen. So he's certainly capable of lighting it up. Last year, I think the game in Columbia had 16 three-pointers and ran away. And then the following weekend, they went to Cornell, and they shot pretty poorly from three in that 1-point loss. But I still think it's going to be that's going to be the main thing to look at. But I will say with Columbia, I'm actually really impressed with how they've regrouped after Mike Smith's injury. Gabe Stefanini slid over from the 2 spot to the point guard spot. His point production has really taken a hit, but he's averaging almost 7 assists a game. He's really, really, really doing a great job in sacrificing himself for the team. I think Brumont and Tepe are playing really well, and they're improving in the front court. Maybe they get away with, they've got to battle Warren and Jimmy Bayon down low. And maybe that's a place that the three-pointers aren't hitting for them. Maybe they can take advantage down low.
Yeah, and I was impressed with the Lions pulling out the win as they did at the end at Binghamton to start the year, January 2nd to be exact. Not a great Binghamton team, obviously. They're a sub 300 KenPom, but anytime you can get a win on the road, and pull out a close game, especially when you're without your best offensive player, that's meaningful. And they didn't look too bad in losses to certainly an overtime loss to Rutgers. And losses to Boston College and Northwestern, you know, they seem to, they're in the right direction for all the reasons that you described. They're a very good 3-point shooting team. Following a team like Penn the last couple of weeks, You compare them to Columbia. Columbia is a good free throw shooting team, actually. Not something that not something that you take for granted. And so Colombia does have that going for them. They seem to be they're a little bit less turnover prone this year too, actually, which is interesting. Given Mike Smith's absence.
Stefanini, yeah.
Right, exactly. Right. Well, no, it goes, yeah, Stefanini has been, you know, he's maybe he's flown under the radar a bit from a league perspective, but certainly he's helping to fortify where Colombia is at. Support for a team that really needs it.
Yeah, and I think they deserve a tremendous amount of credit. You know, I don't know if any team lost as much heading into this season between transfers, Lucas Meisner going off to play pro ball in Germany, graduation. Then you add Mike Smith's injury. I mean, they're playing. You know, I think they've regrouped their play. As you said, they're playing better and better. They had some really good, as you could say, a good non-conference loss. You know, they had a number of those. And they seem to have really, really gotten together. I saw them play Iona at Madison Square Garden. You know, that they seem they're on their way. And I don't know if the record will reflect it this year, but I certainly think the pieces are in place for next year and beyond, which is a nice thing to see.
Yeah, they are an obviously well coached team, and I think that's been borne out the past couple of weeks, that the fact that they are trending up. Cornell, coming off of, as we noted last week, a big historic night for Matt Morgan, the 38-point explosion at Towson. And, you know, Cornell, it's hard to pinpoint any one thing that they're great at other than having Matt Morgan, to put it kind of crudely. But they, again, they're a well-coached team too. They're pretty good at guarding the three-point line, which, again, is so crucial in the Ivy League. I feel like a broken record, but that does come up over and over again. They're not a team that crashes the offensive boards. They are very conservative in the way that they play their defense. It's a get back, make you beat them kind of defense. And sometimes they do get beat, but the defense has improved substantially from last season. I think that's the one thing that is worth noting. The Big Red is they have taken strides on that end of the floor.
Yeah, I remember that I was at that game at Columbia last year after they had lost to Penn and Princeton, and they got blown out by Princeton. Penn had more free throws, they would have gotten blown out in that game as well. And then Columbia took them to task as well. And they, in talking to the coach afterwards, they just seemed out of sorts, especially on the defensive end. And then they won that one-point game. I think they had another close game against Dartmouth a week later. They really turned it around. They obviously don't have loss for this year's team, but the defense as a whole has gotten much better, which keeps them in games. And then again, Nathan's written about it a number of times this year for IHO. George has written about spoken about it, that if you can keep the game close and you've got Matt Morgan, I mean, he's going to probably end up as the number two all-time Ivy scorer. You'd certainly have a chance. And, I'd have to say, Brian Earle was a tremendous Ivy League guard, but his front court teaching is amazing. Getting's improved tremendously with him. Josh Warren, Jimmy Boeheim also have shown growth this year. So they have a couple other pieces other than Morgan. Not a lot, I'll admit, but they certainly have enough. If they can keep Columbia off the three-point line, they certainly have a chance at home to win this game.
Yeah, it figures to be another close one, you would think. And of course, it's got huge implications when you think about all the last weekend and all the mathematical possibilities that are likely to crop up again for sliding in as that number four seed. You just know it's going to come up again down to that last weekend as Cornell got to learn and enjoy last season. Cornell last season though did not have a great time at Levian. Did much better at Newman. Actually was able to pick off the really crucial win, 1 point win, for the Big Red last year. So they split last year, see how it goes this year, starting at Newman Saturday. Moving on to the women's side, here's what happened, last week. Dead air, nothing happened at all. That makes our job on Inside Ivy Hoops that much easier when there's less to recap. I have less to say, and everybody's happy. But this week it's a very different story. We've got a Big Five matchup on tap with Penn going up against Villanova, which of course the Red and Blue were able to beat last year. Yale Brown, Columbia Cornell, Dartmouth Harvard. We've got a lot going on. Very, very meaningful weekend on the women's side. What are your thoughts on? Let's start with Yale Brown. They're intriguing because they're such a venerable team. You've got Shayna Mehta. It feels like she was Ivy Rookie of the Year a long, long time ago. Still on the team and so much offensive firepower there, but a disappointing slide last season. And Yale, quite the opposite. They've won a lot of hardware lately. The WBI last season. And getting it done this season as well. What do you see as far as how this match plays out?
Yeah, it's fascinating. They split last year to start Ivy play. Brown had I know I've written about this a number of times that Brown, like this year's men team, the women's team had their all-time best non-conference record. Kind of goes downhill from there. Part of it was the injury, and part of it is also the Ivy League is one of the top 10, 11 conferences in the country. It's very defensive oriented, and Brown is a much more offensively oriented squad. They are the most experienced team in the league. Right now, their five starters were the same group that was out in the first semifinal in 2017. So they are experienced. But it's the defense that's the problem. They will be able to set the pace they always do. It's just can they rebound? Inside defense. That is the three that's been a little bit of a trouble spot for them. But Yale, luckily in a way, like Yale is I should say Yale is tenacious and they win ugly. They play a really great defensive game. And to Allison Guth's credit, she adapts every year to her different teams. Last year, they were one of the nation's best in steals. They pressed a lot. This year, they've kind of packed it in and protected the paint. They reached out to the Virginia coach to learn everything they could about the pack line defense, and it's showing. Roxy Berriman is the leading scorer in the Ivy League. Again, maybe not the most efficient in terms of her percentages, but she definitely puts those points up. Camilla Emsbow came in as a top 50 recruit nationally and has certainly not disappointed. So they have inside and outside. Yale's biggest problem, they rebound really well defensively as well. With the offense, it's just the three-point shooting is really suspect. If Brown can kind of force them to shoot more threes and win or lose the game on the outside, then I think they have a chance. And I think it's a really, I know it's the first game, but I think it's really important for the psyche at Brown. If they can hold it at home, you know, then you go into Yale and you're playing with house money. You know, worst you do is a split, and maybe you sweep, and that's really important because Yale was picked fourth in the pre-conference media poll. But if you lose at home, I think that puts a lot more pressure on Brown the following week. So I'm thinking they're going to come out with a sense of urgency. It's just, does that create a positive or negative result for them?
Right. And yeah, I mean, point well taken about Yale's adaptability and flexibility on defense. I mean, they were able to win the FAU Holiday Classic earlier this season entirely, almost entirely through a suffocating defense. And that's pretty much been on display all year long. In fact, they haven't played since then. So they've got a long layoff, and then how they respond to that layoff going into the matchup at Providence, in Providence, I should say, is going to be interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly a game that I feel like it's going to be a revealing game. You never know about teams until they hit the conference slate what their ultimate fate is going to be and what they're really made of. And I think we learned that, you know, we've learned that about Brown in the past. I think we could learn about it in the going the other direction, positive direction for them too. It should be noted though, is from a non-conference perspective, the Ivy League is 29-8 over the last 37 non-conference games. And that says a great deal. I mean, this is definitely it's definitely a good league, and it has been for some time. It ranks fourth in the nation in percentage of teams above or at 500, greater than the Big Ten, greater than the Pac-12, greater than the SEC. It's the team that, or it's a conference that wins a lot. You've got programs on the rise, you know, many more that are on the rise than are treading water, I would say, at this point, or seem to be, that is. And one of them that seems to be on the rise and has a lot of momentum right now is Columbia. And, of course, Megan Griffith was on the podcast last week talking about the big win at Mercer. Momentum that the team has going into its tilt with Cornell this weekend. Columbia is an extraordinarily young team, quite the opposite of Brown, which is the interesting comparison between the two, I suppose. But you know, Columbia, you've got Sienna Durr, you've got a team that does a lot of the. Is increasingly doing a lot of the little things well. And then you've got a Cornell squad that was projected to place in the bottom of the league. But, I mean, it's hard to get a read. This game, I feel like it could go either way. What are your thoughts on this matchup?
Yeah, I'll take a step back from Brown. I think I mixed it up. You know, for Brown, it's their strength versus Yale's weakness out on the outside of the court. But moving back to Columbia Cornell, you know, I know Megan Perry over at the Road to Ivy podcast is very big on Columbia. Also, I think she considers them a dark horse for the Ivy tournament. I don't know if I'm as sold as everyone else. I mean, I do agree with everything you're saying. You know, they have some tremendous athletes that have joined the program. This is Megan Griffith's third year, but in reality, this is her first recruiting class. And she, you know, that team was so dominated by Camille Zimmerman the last few years, one of the all-time Ivy greats. So this feels like year one for the rebuild. And, you know, they've got eight players that are first or second years that are in the top 10 rotation players. And, you know, there's some real talent there. As you said, Sienna Durr, Madison Hardy, Riley Casey. You know, Casey struggled early in the season, but, you know, now is clicking. She's had, I think, 54, 55 points in her last two games. Offensively, they've been around the middle of the pack of the conference. The last couple games, maybe they've moved up a little bit. So I think that's trending in the positive direction. The defense is a bit of a work in progress. You know, I think they allow a fair number of points. They give up a lot inside the arc. They're okay on the boards, but there's a lot of room for growth. So, you know, again, I'll go back to the fact that this is a defensive league. Princeton coach Courtney Banghart, in her weekly report before the first Penn game, said that, you know, looking back over the last couple of years, the team with the best defense has won in the Ivy League. And that's how it plays out. So I think the offense is trending upward, and the defense, there has to be some more attention paid. And I think that will come in time. Cornell, I think you see a little bit of the opposite end of the spectrum. I think, as Megan Griffith pointed out, like Dana Smith has a core philosophy. It's a very defensive philosophy. She sticks with it, and it's really strong. You know, they certainly can hold their own with the top defensive teams in the league, like Penn, Yale, Princeton. Their defense is top notch. Where they're struggling is, and they also have a pretty good inside play also. Laura Bagwell Katalinich, I apologize if I didn't pronounce her name correctly, you know, has been really a revelation this season. She played, I think, 3 games in 11 minutes as a freshman at Penn, and transferred to Cornell, and she is just starring for the Big Red. One of the league's best rebounders. She's basically a double-double every night. And Sam Widman is having, you know, her numbers have gone down a little bit as Lauren has now been there to share some of the inside presence, but she's still an incredibly talented front court player. They have a really solid first-year forward, Grace Mbenefo. Again, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing everything correctly. But she's a first year, and she's really coming into her own. It kind of reminds me of Jaden Bush at Harvard, same kind of game. So I think they're really set on the inside, but their three-point shooting is really troubling. The percentage is low, and they don't take a lot of shots. And, you know, as you said with the men's group, you know, you still need to be able to shoot the threes. You know, I think that was a major reason why Penn ended up beating Princeton a couple weeks ago with Phoebe Sturba coming out of nowhere to hit 5 of 7. So long-term, going through the 14-game tournament for Cornell, that three-pointer is going to be a big problem. I don't know if it's going to play its head on Saturday. I think Cornell will still be able to handle it because their defense will win out. But you know, I don't know if I see a sweep the following weekend down in New York City with that.
Yeah, it's impressive. Bagwell Katalinich leads the league by a country mile in free throw percentage too, for somebody that's you know, such a tenacious front court player. You don't often see that. But yeah, taking a broader view, it's going to be interesting to see how. What wins out, I guess, an offense or defense, to put it pretty crudely, in this matchup. But yeah, I mean, you do need Columbia, if they can round into shape defensively, not a veteran team, but as the slate goes on, you know, you do need defense in those back-to-backs, because as we've already touched on, it's hard to always get shooting. It's hard to always get maximum energy on offense and precision when you're playing those, you know, this, doing these slogs, these back to backs, you know, I think that's where the Dana Smith approach and makeup of that roster can come into play. Cornell also a very aggressive defense. Leading the conference in steals, so it's not just like a pack line approach. They also go out and get after you aggressively, defensively too. It's not just let you come to us type of thing. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting. I mean, they were picked to finish 7th and 8th in the conference, but it may not shake out that way. I mean, it's a lot to be determined in this back. If one team can score a sweep, you know, that would be huge in potentially catapulting one of these two teams to be a dark horse candidate mathematically in it down the stretch, or maybe even better. And we'll see if the weather cooperates too. Aren't we supposed to get a lot of snow this this weekend? Yeah, I hope we don't have any rescheduling.
We don't. I wrote to them to see if there's been any contingency plans put in place. But I think from what I saw on the computer there, starting Saturday afternoon, it's going to start snowing. But I think the heaviest stuff comes Saturday night, but it'll probably be over a foot. So maybe they'll get the games in, and then the Columbia group can hightail it out of Ithaca before the snow shows up.
Yeah. It's always, you know, it's always something this time of year with the weather. You never escape it entirely, and it always seems to center around Cornell somehow.
Yeah,
there's always snow, or there's always the lights go out at Newman, or something happens. I mean, it's just, you know, it's always Newman. It's always,
yes,
Newman. But the other women's matchup this weekend, taking place at Harvard. Harvard hosts Dartmouth. That game at 2:00 Saturday, an hour after Columbia and Cornell hopefully tip off, and a day after Yale and Brown. Pretty unusual tip in the grand scheme of the season. 11 a.m. Getting back to Dartmouth and Harvard. You've got a Dartmouth team that very narrowly missed out on the conference tournament last year. They rank second in scoring margin in the league, behind only Penn. But you've got some returning talent for Dartmouth, and a Harvard team that has been pretty hard to beat at Leviades. Historically and certainly recently, under Harvard, a pretty potent offensive team. Certainly good at getting a lot of good looks from inside and out. Pretty potent, easily leading the conference in 3-point field goal percentage. How do you see this matchup playing out, or what intrigues you about it?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? You've got 2 7-6 teams. In some ways, it's kind of like the Harvard-Dartmouth men's game. You know, as you pointed out, Harvard's excelling on offense. They leading the league in 2-point shooting, 3-point shooting, assist rate.
Right.
They beat Cal. Which is pretty phenomenal. They went they got on a plane after playing Rhode Island. They went out to Cal. They beat them by 6. That was pretty impressive. So I think offensively they're set, especially at home where they were undefeated last year. And they lost 3 this year to some really good teams, Quinnipiac, Rutgers. So they it's not like they lost to weaker competition. But then they have another 3-game win streak right now. So they're like the Princeton men. Maybe the break came at the wrong time for them, but they've been playing really well. The defense, I think, is not as elite as some of the best in the conference, but I still think it's pretty solid. I like Harvard a lot. I think in some ways, I think they are top to bottom. You know, they're set. It's not like, you know, a couple weeks ago we might have said with Penn, like, well, you know, the defense is tremendous and their 2-point shooting is good and their 3-point struggles. I think with Harvard, they may not, you know, I think they've got all parts of the game set. Maybe if there's a issue with them, it might be consistency. I think last year and this year in the non-conference schedule, that's something that Coach Delaney Smith has pointed to. But I think everything is set in place. They lost Taylor Rooks, who became a grad transfer to Michigan, who was a really intimidating presence on the inside. But Jaden Bush has stepped up and played really well, especially the first half of the non-conference schedule. And recently, Rachel Levy, second year from Boca, has really stepped in. So, and then you got Jeannie Bame. So you know, you've got three really solid front court players. And I think you see at Dartmouth a similar team. They shoot the three well. They play defense well. I think they may be a slight notch below Harvard in a lot of those metrics, but they're right there. Ice Quinones, again, her play has – she was good last year. She's even better this year. She played in the World Cup for Puerto Rico, seems to have really improved her game. Cy Lippold showing that last year was not a fluke. She's a great three-point shooter, really pushes the pace and leads that team. Annie McKenna, another smaller point guard, has been teamed with Lippold in the backcourt, so they have a lot of energy. They really get the ball in. I think they have a better front court presence than they did last year. Paula Leinart is in there. They have a couple second years. Ann Luce and Elle Louie both have grown tremendously this year. So I think they can certainly match Harvard. Last year they won in Dartmouth and they had Harvard on the ropes looking for the sweep and they couldn't get it. I think both games are going to be, you know, if Harvard shoots the three the way they did, you know, against Cal, it may not be close, but I think realistically these are two close games and home court may just be the determining factor in both.
Yeah, it'll be – it will be if Harvard wants to, you know, get the top seed in the conference tournament, expectations are always high in Cambridge. This is definitely a game you have to win. And conversely, if you're Dartmouth and you want to – prove that you've gotten over the top in terms of talent and cohesion this year in qualifying for the tournament. You know, this would be a huge way to start off and keep the Crimson from holding serve at home.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, last year Dartmouth not only missed by one game, they came in fifth by one game, but if they had still tied, I think they would have lost the tiebreakers. So, you know, these games, especially when you're facing the traditional upper division teams, Harvard, Princeton, Penn, that puts a little added weight on the teams who are on the outside looking in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all the games are weighted equally. So the ones that we remember is usually the last weekend or the last couple of weekends when we're towards the finish line and everything's rounding into shape. But in retrospect, these games are huge because they kind of set the tone. And, a Dartmouth win would be huge here for the Big Green program. And it's certainly feasible, but it's going to be tough. It's tough to beat Harvard at home where, they just seem to get the shooting and they feed off of the crowd and get things going. Familiarity. The gym seems to be big there too. Katie Benson, certainly a huge story this year. Nothing really new from her. Huge from 3-point, also leading the league in assist to turnover ratio too. Does way more than just shoot threes, which I think we've all acknowledged and appreciated at this point. So that's a lot of action going on this weekend.
Yeah,
there's a lot to see how it shakes out. But let's hope we don't have any more injuries because that's the last thing we can afford at this point. That's what I've learned to as editor. I just root for injury-free games. Good games and injury-free games. That's the goal. So let's hope we can get there. Any other storylines that intrigue you this weekend, Rob? Have we covered everything?
I think we've Yeah, so, you know, I guess if I throw a little wrinkle out there, you know, we've already touched on the snow in Ithaca. My other thing would be we're almost at the six-month anniversary of the Penn investigation of Jerome Allen's bribery scandal. No word from the university on how that's going. Seems like a bit of a state secret, and, you know, many more important commissions had ended much quicker. So I'm hoping that there's some resolution to that hanging chad over in West Philly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think we already know enough to come down on the situation, I guess. If I mean, we already know what he's admitted to. The $18,000 bribe, but it's you know, obviously disappointing. It's something that he's apologized for. The extent of it, what, you know, are there other details? Are there other, you know, are there other moving parts here that aren't known that are being found out perhaps by Penn Athletics? You know, how much is going into this? How much are they spending, you know, to try to get to the bottom of this? There's a lot of, I suppose there's a lot of questions that are floating out there to be pondered and to be answered. You know, we'll definitely be keeping our eyes open and looking out for that, on that for sure. Rob Brown, thank you so very much for stopping by. All the awesome work that you do for IHO, I know our listeners appreciate it, and I know I do too. We'll see how this weekend shakes out, but thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for giving me the time, and I appreciate it, Mike. And you know, just want to do a shout out to all the other great writers we've got at IHO, and you know, Thank you also to the people at NYC Buckets and City of Basketball Love for all the great work they put in over the years. And we're going to keep the torch lit for Ivy League basketball. And hopefully we got a bunch of great games this weekend. Thanks, Mike.
Well said, Rob. Thanks.